Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com.
It's an encore edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Alyssa Altman fell in love with food, the fancier the better, as a child. But when she fell in love for real as an adult, her relationship with food changed dramatically. She's written about these dual love stories in her memoir, Poor Man's Feast, a love story of comfort, desire, and the art of simple cooking. She also blogs at poormansfeast.com. Hello, Alyssa.
Hello, good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And let's go back to your childhood. You had kind of a strange relationship with food in your childhood. On one hand, you had a mother who didn't like to eat, discouraged others from eating, and wasn't a very good cook. So what was food like in your home?
Oh, my goodness. Well, All true and all accurate about my mom. My mom still to this day doesn't like to cook, doesn't much like to eat, and doesn't much like it when other people eat. But when I was growing up, whenever my mother cooked, she invariably made lamb chops and immolated them. So to me, if she was in the kitchen, I knew that minutes later I was going to be running into the bedroom with the dog cowering from the flames that were licking up and out of our chamber's stove. So she had a very sort of cantankerous relationship with food. And on the flip side, my dad loved food, and in all its guises and manners and styles. And he was actually, he himself, and it's something that I don't really talk too much about, but he himself was a wonderful cook. If I was compelled to learn how to cook, it was probably because of him rather than because of my mother, although he used to say that I learned to cook out of self-defense because my mom is just not so good in the kitchen.
Well, and you write a lot. I mentioned that your mom doesn't like it when other people eat. And Your mom, it sounds like she was constantly picking at you about the food that you were putting in your body.
Yeah, this is true. I mean, my mom is a former model and was modeling as recently as 10, 15 years ago. She was a fur model. And I bear no resemblance to her. She's tall and skinny and lanky, and I'm not. And she grew, when she was a child growing up in Brooklyn in the 1940s, she felt she did not have a good body image, let's just put it that way. And she grew up as a singer. She was a singer, a child singer on radio, and knew that she wanted to be on television at the earliest days of television. She wanted to be sort of what we would think of now as like the girl singer on television. And she felt that she needed to be much thinner than she was. And so when she was in high school, she put herself on a crazy diet that involved coffee, enormous amounts of coffee. And she lost a ton of weight. And even now, she will say to me, it was my goal to be as skinny as I could possibly be and never put that weight back on. And so I think that when she saw me growing up and knowing that I loved food and I loved enjoying food with my dad, I think it scared her. And I think that it reminded her of her own fraught experiences with it. And so she kept a very sharp eye on what I ate and a very sharp eye on what my dad ate, so much so that I used to clip the size tags out of my clothes when I was, when I would stay with her.
And as an adult?
Even as an adult, yeah. So, you know, food is sort of like the third person in a relationship that I have with my mom. And, I think of her with great love and tenderness and affection, but she does not have a great relationship with food, indeed.
Well, and this leads to your
dad, his relationship with food, and your relationship with your dad involving food. And I would love for you to read us a little part of the book, because you and your dad used to go on these culinary adventures together.
We did. We used to, my father used to wait. He was great. He was a great strategist, and he would wait until my mother was gone on Saturday morning. She had a standing hair appointment. This was in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and she would have a standing salon appointment, and he would sort of sit there and do the New York Times and wait until she left. And I grew up about 7 miles outside of Manhattan, and when the door closed, and or if we were dropping her off at the salon, he would wait until she went inside, and then he would squirrel me away for these crazy, crazy, very French, very classical lunches, just the two of us. And they were really extraordinary, and probably, I would say, my first experience with what I call high food.
Can you read a little bit for us?
Yeah, absolutely. When my mother left us together on late Saturday mornings while she spent a few hours at the beauty salon, and years later, when she went back to working as a Saturday afternoon fur showroom model in the mid-1970s, my father and I always waited at least half an hour to make sure she wasn't coming back for anything, then got into the car, drove the 7 miles into Midtown Manhattan, and dined together, subversively, under the radar, out of sight. "Make sure to give her a snack around noon," my mother would say to my father as she'd leave the apartment, to which he would nod silently without looking up and finish doing the New York Times crossword puzzle. An hour later, he and I would be sitting together having that snack at Le Perigord or Lutèce. There, in the hushed glow of some of the finest dining rooms in the world, alone with my father, I ate my first escargot de Bourgogne and my first millefeuille, my first foie gras, and my first partridge. I learned how to use a couteau à poisson, a traditional French fish knife, and by the time I was 9, I knew the proper placement of a water goblet versus a sherry glass, and that when the table was cleared, it happened only after both diners were finished, and only from the left. But my father was an egalitarian man. He was just as happy to wave goodbye to my mother as she grabbed her Vuitton tote and headed out for a touch-up and trim at Vidal Sassoon, load me into the Imperial, and drive us to deepest Brooklyn, where we'd sit ourselves down at Brennan and Carr, next to firemen and cops on break, and order a trio of jus-drenched roast beef sandwiches that left my face and hands dripping with beefy goodness. Or we'd head to Rondazzo's Clam Bar in the furthest reaches of Sheepshead Bay for platters of enormous baked clams, redolent of oregano and garlic and melted butter. If my mother's appointment was early and there was no time to sneak into Manhattan or Brooklyn and back before she returned, we'd end up at Ben's Best on Queens Boulevard, where my father introduced me to their specials platter, 2 immense kosher beef franks with the girth of the transatlantic cable nestled in a snood of sweetened baked beans. His taste in food ran the gamut from the sublime to the plebeian. He could rattle off the mother sauces, bechamel, velouté, espagnol, hollandaise, tomato, without hesitation. He could eat an entire jar of grimaces, crispy rendered chicken skin and onions that is known in some circles as Jewish crack for its sheer addictiveness, while visiting his mother for lunch, and then have the quenelle de brochette lyonnaise at Le Grenouille for dinner. He would take the dog out for a walk early on weekend mornings and come home with a can of Spam, which the dog assumed was for him, fry it up in thin rectangular slices, top it with a soft-boiled egg and a squeeze of the cheap black caviar that came in a tube like toothpaste, and set the whole thing down on a pillowy, butter-laden croissant from Dumas on East 60th Street. He'd sit me down at the breakfast counter and hand me a knife and fork while my mother watched, orange melamine cup of Sanka in hand, convinced that I would be scarred for life. But whenever he and I went out alone, and before we walked back through our front door, my father, who carried a pocket-sized lint brush under his car seat, made sure to remove any telltale crumbs from the black velvet Scotch House blazer I'd always wear if we were going fancy, or the red knit poncho I'd put on if we weren't. "Did you remember the snack?" my mother asked him late in the afternoon when we all met up again in the apartment. "What do you think?" he'd snort, turning on the television and pouring himself a small Dewar's.
That's Alyssa Altman reading from her memoir, Poor Man's Feast, A Love Story of Comfort, Desire, and the Art of Simple Cooking. Of course, we're not talking about simple food for the most part right there. Where did your dad's love of cuisine come from?
Well, I think, he grew up in a home in the 1930s, in 1930s Brooklyn, and very sort of very strict traditional Orthodox Jewish home, and his mom, my grandmother, was this Anglophile. I mean, the sort of she was Romanian born, but she was the sort of unaccountable Anglophile. We don't know where it came from or how. And she made it a habit to fill her cabinets and in the kitchen with very high end British packaged products, things like Tiptree jams and Drosti's chocolates, and I believe in my heart of hearts that she felt that those things would sort of propel her into another social class, and I think for a lot of people, the concept of fancy food is sort of a cloak that kind of hides a lurking insecurity, and I think that she had that. So he grew up with the feeling, I believe, that food had the power to be transformative. You know, I think it was also the time. I mean, he left Brooklyn, enlisted in the Navy, became a naval officer in the Second World War, and was had a lot of access to what we would now call fancy food. And certainly in the 1950s, he was an original ad man. He was an ad man, you know, right down to the suits and the ties and the mid-century modern furniture and the clients. And he spent most of the 1950s and 60s going out with clients and in Manhattan, where his office was, and sort of surrounding himself with all the trappings of that life.
I'm talking with Alyssa Altman. She is the author of Poor Man's Feast, A Love Story of Comfort, Desire, and the Art of Simple Cooking. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest today is Alyssa Altman. She is the author of Poor Man's Feast, A Love Story of Comfort, Desire, and the Art of Simple Cooking. And before the break, Alyssa, we were talking about your relationship with your parents and your parents' relationships with food. Your mother, as you mentioned, was a model who wanted to remain extremely thin and sort of had a difficult relationship with food and discouraged you from eating. And you had a dad who loved great food, whether it was fine cuisine or something fabulous from a greasy spoon. And you and your dad had these culinary adventures together. You also write that your parents' relationship was difficult. They did eventually get divorced. And your dad could be a difficult man, even violent on occasion. These happy moments, sharing food together, given the other difficulties in your life, do you think that made them carry extra weight for you?
I think that, I think that food for him was the great leveler. I think it was the playing field leveler, whether it was with me or anyone else. And my dad had, he had the ability to talk to anybody, to enjoy the company of all kinds of people from all over the country. You know, as I said, he'd been in the Navy during the Second World War and had been a night fighter pilot and spent a lot of years training here before he was on his aircraft carrier in the Pacific. And I think that he really reveled in breaking bread with people, and he sort of understood that conviviality, high or low, and by that I mean fancy or not, could bring people together. And that was something that he implied, that was implied in our relationship. You know, I really looked forward to those times with him, and even given his moments of temper, and you know, looking back, I sort of tend to write that off to not being happy. You know, we all either have been in or know people who have been in relationships with the wrong person, and that can really, really take a toll. And he was never happier than when he was at the table, and that became very clear to me.
Both of your parents loved the finer things in life. For your mother, it was, you know, more about clothes and jewelry and purses and things like that. And for your dad, it was about food. Were you a wealthy family?
No. You know, we were your sort of average middle class Queens family, and for my mom, I mean, my mom loved the finer things in life and still does, and she lives in Manhattan, where one can be surrounded with them at, you know, all the time. For my dad, you know, I think that you know, as I said, he believed at least in the earlier parts of his life, and certainly when I was a child, in the concept of fancy, and that fancy, cap F, would somehow elevate him into another social class. And I think that that's very normal. I mean, I you know, when you look around today and you see people buying status symbols, purses and cars and all, you know, very often not necessarily able to afford it. I mean, the question is, why do people do that? Because generally there's an implied sense that it will elevate you out of the place. It's a comfort. It somehow provides comfort and is a, I don't want to say it's sort of a consumerist mood elevator, but it's a consumerist mood elevator.
I think a lot of people have experienced that.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, for better or for worse. And it took him a very long time to and a divorce and finding someone who was very very down to earth and wonderful and who I'm still very close to realize that that comfort can be had in other ways.
And after your parents got divorced, you continued this relationship with your dad primarily through food.
That's correct. You know, we spent years going. I mean, even when I was in college, I mean, he would come up to Boston where I went to school, and we would spend a lot of time going from, you know, restaurant to restaurant, and he taught me everything he knew about it. And you know, it certainly when we had holiday dinners with my family, with his side of the family, which is extended. I have a large raft of cousins and who I'm very close to. You know, dinners were always these kind of elaborate affairs with the sort of creaking table and you know, opened up as far as it could be opened, and very high-end wine and that was great. That was really great, but it took me a long time to realize that, you know, one doesn't necessarily and possibly shouldn't necessarily eat that way on a regular basis.
As you gravitated toward a career in food and enjoyed cooking for yourself, you sort of followed this mantra of the fancier the better.
I did, and in the late 1980s, I went to work at Dean & DeLuca, which the original Dean & DeLuca, which was in Soho, New York, and downtown. And this was at a time where there was a lot of money kicking around. You know, I always say that the late 1980s were all about big, you know, big hair, big shoulder pads, big houses, big cars, and even the plates that we used to use to put our dinners on and were enormous. And you know, I look back at that now, and it was the time of the 14-inch Chargers that were the sort of the size of a Plymouth 1950s Plymouth steering wheel, and food was very fancy, and I was completely convinced that that was the way one needed to learn how to cook, tall and fancy and extreme. And I was at Dean and DeLuca every day, and I went to cooking school at night, and it was a little nutty.
Well, like, I can't imagine an environment that would be more conducive to getting caught up in that.
Right. Well, exactly. And I mean, we had people coming into the store all the time, like Kyle MacLachlan and Isabella Rossellini. My very first day there, Kyle MacLachlan, Isabella Rossellini, and David Lynch walked in, and we were their regular supermarket. I mean, we might as well have been their local Mega Mart. And you know, people would come in and buy $10 tomatoes and $200 an ounce white truffles from Alba. And if I, you know, I had a store discount, which was great, but by the time I sort of cobbled together dinner for myself and then went home, it was $40 later with my discount.
So this book is not just about your relationship with food, your family's relationship with food, but it's also about your relationship with Susan, the love of your life, and how that also affected your relationship with food. But let's talk about when you met Susan, because you were both single at the time, and you'd both just recently ended relationships.
Right, right. Well, she had just ended a relationship a few years earlier, and I had ended a relationship a few years before, and had really been spending most of my time focusing on feeding my friends and feeding myself and throwing these crazy, crazy dinner parties. I was living at the time in a 450 square foot studio apartment on East 57th Street in Manhattan. It had this porthole like window, and I faced it. You know, it was like it was such a cliche. I mean, I faced another brick building, and I used to have to sort of strain, you know, look out the window and crane my neck and look up to see the sky to see what the weather was like, because I had no natural light. But I did have this 7-foot square kitchen, and I used to cook crazy things out of it, and on a regular basis. And when Susan and I met, I mean, she was living alone in this tiny house, a little cape up in northern Connecticut, and her town was a town of 3,500 people. They had gotten their first stoplight in 1996, and we met online. Everybody asks, how did we meet? We met online, and we discovered that we really had polar opposite ways of cooking and thinking about food. And she loved food just as much as I did, and she loved cooking for people just as much as I do. But it was very, very different. And that difference could have proven, I suppose, to have been a hurdle, but in fact it's what really brought us together, and you know, we're going on 14 years now.
I'm talking with Alyssa Altman. She is the author of Poor Man's Feast, A Love Story of Comfort, Desire, and the Art of Simple Cooking. And you mentioned you met online, and in that post where you had described yourself and what you were looking for, you said you wanted to meet someone who loved food and loved to cook. So that was part of what brought you together in the first place.
Right. That's exactly right. And, you know, I always say that life is complicated enough, and I think that it's you know, lucky are the couples who meet with sort of little in common, and they're able to make a go of it. But I think that for me, it was really important to meet somebody who had a really good relationship with food, and whatever that meant, you know, whether it was people who like to cook fancy or somebody who was just a good home cook, because that's an art. You know, being just a great home cook who knows how to make a good steak is an art.
Even though in the early parts of your relationship where you were just exchanging emails, you were talking about Thanksgiving dinner, you were a little shocked at some of the simplicity of her foods.
I was shocked. I mean, Susan's mom, that very first Thanksgiving, we were writing back and forth, and I had just come back to my apartment from Thanksgiving with my cousins, which is something that we did every year. And there were usually 20 of us, and there was often half a case of really delicious, very expensive wine. There were things like, flan dusted with pumpkin flan dusted with crushed candied violets. And so when we were talking after that first Thanksgiving was over, and, you know, she said, What did you have? And I told her, and I had asked her the same thing, and she said, a roast beef, and a bottle of something that she called the big Italian lady, and I had no idea what that was, and it was basically this very large bottle of very inexpensive Italian red wine with a picture of a larger Italian lady on the label, and. You know, there was no half a case of Zinsky Pinot Noir from the north side of the vineyard kind of thing. It was just what it was, and that was really one of our first conversations, and it really exemplified how very different two people who love food and love feeding people can actually be.
When you had your first date in person, and she came into the city and you went out to dinner, you share this nugget of wisdom from your father, and it's such incredibly good advice, and I've never heard anybody give it before. But because, of course, you were inclined to take her to the fanciest restaurant you could think of, but your dad had told you always let your date choose the restaurant.
That's correct. He did, because it basically would let you off the hook. You know, if something went wrong, you would be off the hook. And as I said about him, I mean, he just loved people, and he loved food, and he could go high or he could go low. He preferred high. But that was, that was the nugget of wisdom that I took away from his experience. And of course, I envisioned my taking Susan to this extraordinary and very expensive French bistro where, to feel comfortable in there, you kind of have to dress French, So I would go in there in my, in my Gucci loafers and my jeans and my, no socks. And we all know what that kind of thing looks like. And that was what my plan was. And, you could, and as I say, it's the kind of place where New Yorkers go to pretend they're French. And instead, Susan just wanted to go out for a big Polish breakfast at this Greasy Spoon on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. It's now gone, unfortunately. And instead of, caviar and steak tartare, we wound up having plates of kielbasa and fried eggs and pierogi and that was what we had, and endless cups of lukewarm coffee, sort of served in those great old Buffalo China cups that weigh a ton. And we sat there for hours and hours, and it was just a wonderful way to meet.
As you got closer together, I mentioned how you were somewhat dismayed by her cooking and the simplicity of it, but she also had a very similar reaction to some of the fancier things that you did. You mentioned when you like to cook, the taller the better.
Right.
She was really kind of aghast at that.
Yeah, and I remember making this one dish for her and sort of putting it down in front of her, and she looked at me and said, "How am I supposed to eat this? What am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to knock it over first?" And, and we've certainly all been in situations like that where we've gone out to fancier restaurants and that cook obviously in service to trend, and so the food is taller, it's kind of three-dimensional, it's vertical, and, if you're ever in a situation like that, watch the expressions on your dining partner's faces when the plate gets set down in front of you, because people don't know how to eat that kind of food. And so I came away from cooking school and Dean and DeLuca believing that was the way I was supposed to cook. It was impressive, and that's why people cook, is to impress, and et cetera, et cetera. And that was really the first time that I cooked for her, and she said, "What am I? You know, how am I supposed to eat this?" And she sort of knocked it over. I think it was a lamb shank, and she knocked it over like a tree falling in the forest, and just laughed. And thank goodness she just laughed. I'm happy that she has a wonderful sense of humor.
But that must have been very interesting for you to see her reaction to something that you were so proud of and really represented something important about you.
You know, I think she was very kind about it. and she is a very kind, innately kind person. But I think she was very kind about it and was gentle in her implication that it was really a completely ridiculous way to eat. and just didn't get it at all. And I, you know, over the almost 14 years that we've been together, I mean, I've really learned how to rethink about the way I cook at home.
I'm Charity Nebbe. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back to the conversation in a moment. You're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
My guest is Alyssa Altman. She is the author of Poor Man's Feast, a love story of comfort, desire, and the art of simple cooking. She also blogs at poormansfeast.com. She'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City on Friday night at 7 o'clock. And Alyssa, before the break, we were talking about how when you met Susan, the love of your life, the two of you both had this very strong connection with food, but a very different kind of connection with food, in that you had always sort of felt that the fancier, the better. And she believed in simple food, and that it didn't really matter what it was as long as you enjoyed it and as long as you had good company. And as your relationship evolved, it was so interesting to read about how you evolved as well. And I'm sure she changed too, but this is your story. So, but you know, you were living in Manhattan, you were preparing tall dishes and having fancy dinner parties at your tiny little apartment. And she was up in Northern Connecticut in a little house with a dog and lots of family around. And you found yourself really pulled in her direction.
I did. And you know, I think that Susan really adheres to certainly the culinary concept that the best way to cook is as simple as possible with the best ingredients that you can find and do as little to them as humanly possible. So her idea of a fabulous meal would be a perfectly poached egg on a piece of toast, on a piece of sourdough toast, maybe rubbed with a little bit of garlic and a little bit of olive oil, and that was it. And I would, if I was in the kitchen, it would be the poached egg on a piece of toast with some tapenade and maybe a squeeze of this and a drizzle of that and a squiggle of this. And thank goodness she has a good sense of humor. That's all I can say.
I love your story about when you first planted a garden together, and you were excited about planting the garden, but you didn't have any idea what to do with it in the kitchen.
Now, that's true. And you know, growing up in New York, I mean, I did not have a green thumb. I didn't even have a black thumb. And we're not gardening people in New York so much. But here I was in love, and Susan's backyard consisted of about three quarters of an acre, absolutely flat, completely sun splashed, and she had grown up with a mom who had been the daughter of a subsistence farmer. And this is a woman, she's now 95 years old, who can throw anything into the ground and it will grow. And so Susan and I decided to plant a garden. And we went a little overboard and we planted, I think it was, initially it was four raised beds that were about 10 feet long and 4 feet across. And we planted enormous amounts of lettuce and root vegetables, and I think we planted onions the first year. And we had harvest after harvest after harvest, and I had no idea what to do with this stuff, because when you believe in cooking fancy food, you know, you don't really necessarily see the beauty in pulling something out of the ground and, you know, rubbing the dirt off of it and roasting it and drizzling it with olive oil and sprinkling it with salt. You want to do as much to it as you possibly can. So it was really a learning curve for me. And at this point, I'm totally hooked. And we just built a new garden last year at our new house, and I love doing it. The only thing that Susan will not let me do, and this is also something that I talk about, is mow. I had never mowed before. Before I met Susan, and the first time I did it, I mowed in circles, which I'm sure that in Iowa you will all find pretty funny, because, you know, they look like crop circles, I'm sure.
Well, I wish I was married to someone who wouldn't let me mow, so I think you're actually fortunate on that front. I love the part about eating a sliced tomato, a warm sliced tomato out of the garden, because you thought you didn't even like raw tomatoes.
Well, yeah. I mean, I grew up at a time when, my idea of fresh produce was going down the street to the little Associated grocery store at the end of our block and buying shrink-wrapped heads of lettuce and these tomatoes that were sort of cottony and bland and not even juicy, not even watery. They were just sort of bland, and so it was lost on me, and I grew up believing that tomatoes were just not something for me, that I just didn't like them, and certainly didn't like them uncooked. And during the one of the warmer days during the summer, Susan was out in the garden with her mom, and she took a loaf of white bread, a jar of Hellman's mayonnaise, a knife, and went down our back stairs into the garden, cut a tomato off the vine, sliced it on the spot, stuck it between two pieces of bread and some mayonnaise, and I could just see her enjoying it, from our back deck. And when she made one for me, it was a game changer. It was just something that just, you know, reeks of summer and freshness. And that was my first experience with the beauty of seasonal, fresh food, and that's changed everything for me.
I almost envy you that epiphany moment. That must have been so beautiful.
It was very delicious, and of course, I had to restrain myself from saying, well, you know, it's great, but it would be great with cheese on it, or maybe some basil, or how about some pesto, or it was really, really exquisite, and something that I'll always remember.
So that was 12 years ago or so.
Yes.
How would you characterize your relationship with food now and how it's changed?
Well, it is really it's really changed remarkably. Even when I'm going out, when we're going out, we really make it a point to go to places that are dedicated to serving simple food in the best preparations and the sort of simplest preparations that can be accomplished. But in my own home, We no longer have timbal molds. I no longer have a larding needle. I don't have dowels anymore. For me, I am completely dedicated to the art of simple food and to taking and finding and taking the simplest ingredients, the best quality that I can find and that I can possibly afford, and doing as little to them as possible. And that's my mantra in my kitchen now, whether I'm making soup or vegetables or bread or meat. It's just got to be really, really easy. I tend now to also create much smaller dishes. So where Susan and I used to sit down and have dinner on a Saturday night, and it was sort of not course after course after course, but, you know, three courses was not out of the ordinary for us. It's usually just a small plate of something really delicious and a great glass of wine.
Now, of course, as a blogger, you share your recipes, you share your feelings about food with people. And it strikes me that in this evolution, not only has how you like to eat changed, but before, although the food that you made, the food that you ate, said quite a bit about you, it feels like your transformation has also been to see food in a larger sense.
Yeah, I do think of food in the way that my father thought of it. And I think that knowing about it or not, he was attached to food because it spoke of conviviality. My father loved people, and people generally loved him. And I feel very much the same way. In terms of the larger picture, the way we think about food and the way I think about food now, we live in a society that is ironically glued to the Food Network, but so few people actually cook. And I've come out of this, this sort of epiphany, believing that if everyone in this country knew how to cook a simple steak or how to properly cook vegetables from scratch or even just how to poach an egg, I think that we would be in a very different place health-wise. I think that sitting down together and not eating on the fly certainly would help us as a culture, because we are pulled from pillar to post all the time. It doesn't matter if you live in the city or the country or in the suburbs. People are holding down two jobs, in some cases three jobs. If you have kids, that's a whole other job, albeit a wonderful one. And it's very hard in this country to not think of food as fuel and to think of it as sustenance. And the thing that I always talk about when I speak about conviviality and really learning how to change the way, learning how to rethink about the way I eat, I think that it's really going to be necessary for us as a culture to find ways to sit down and break bread together, even if it's a half an hour on a school night. Just get everybody around the table and do as little as you possibly can to the best ingredients that you can afford. And I know it's complicated, and I know people sort of roll their eyes when I say that, but it's so, so, so important.
This book is about food, but it's also about your love story and finding the person that you wanted to spend the rest of your life with. What do you hope that people take away from that part of the story?
Well, I think that the idea that love can change everything if you're open to it. For me, meeting Susan was not only about meeting this incredibly wonderful person who was kind and compassionate and funny and decent and who I just got along really, really well with. It was also about letting her teach me about the way she thought about food, and to really, she exemplified the fact that for me that our, you know, as MFK Fisher once said, our three basic needs for hope and security and love are intertwined. And, you know, food and nurturing is a very big part of that. In terms of who we are, I mean, we're sort of, if you're asking more of a kind of political question, you know, we are, Susan and I are as sort of normal and basic and everyday couple as one could ever meet. And
well, was that part of your hope? Because, I mean, this is a love story between two mature women. I mean, you mm-hmm. were grown-ups. This isn't the kind of love story that we read often, because this is, I guess, for most of us, this is the kind of love story we live in many ways, that, you know, as an adult, you fall in love with a person who suits you, and there aren't the plot twists and turns and conflicts that we turn into stories so often. But this is a lovely love story of two mature women. Was that part of your hope, that you could show that to people and people could say, yeah, I see myself in that?
You know, I certainly, and I do want people to take comfort from and inspiration from the story wherever they can. You know, this is my life, and this is Susan's life, and you know, I couldn't share my life without telling the story of, you know, the fact that we're two women, we're 49 and 59. We're about as settled could possibly ever be. I suppose that somewhere I did want, and I do want, folks to take comfort from that. And also folks who may not necessarily be so familiar with same-sex couples who have been in a relationship for a really long time, to also take something away as well, you know. And we have a solid, long-standing relationship that is grounded in love and affection and mutual respect, and we've changed each other's lives in tremendous ways, and we're very close to each other's families, as very different as our families are. And it's been a really wonderful, peaceful, happy-making thing.
You are traveling the country right now on a book tour. What's the best thing you've eaten on the road so far?
Oh, my goodness gracious. Well, I have just come from, I haven't been to Iowa City yet, so I can't really say, you know, if it's the best, but so far, because I'm sure that I'm going to be eating some spectacular food when I get to Iowa City, and also in Chicago, and I'll be in Minneapolis tomorrow. I went to a wonderful restaurant in Portland, Oregon, called Pok Pok, which is they serve Thai street food, and I had a very sort of ostensibly simple roast chicken that was kind of glazed with chili and spices and lemongrass, and my stomach is rumbling just talking about it, and it was just wonderful.
Alyssa, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Alyssa Altman is the author of Poor Man's Feast, a love story of comfort, desire, and the art of simple cooking. She also blogs at poormansfeast.com. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. You can get in touch with us anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We're on Twitter @IowaPublicRadio and on Facebook as well. And you never have to miss an episode of Talk of Iowa. Please subscribe to the podcast. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.